The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Dr. Sean Baker is a lifelong multi-sport elite level athlete and a medical doctor who served as a combat trauma surgeon and chief of orthopedics while deployed to Afghanistan with the United States Air Force. His focus in recent years has been on using nutrition as a tool for health, performance, and overall well-being. To find out more about Dr. Sean Baker, visit his website, sean-baker.com. That's sean-baker.com. Sean, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast today. How are you, brother?
Pete, I'm doing wonderful. It's good to be virtually in Australia. Are you in Australia right now? Because I'm virtually there.
I am actually. I'm in a hotel room in Melbourne. I've just been working down here and technology, I love it because we can actually do this anywhere around the world, and I'm actually doing it off my phone, so it's a lot of fun, and thank you for your time today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I think it's going to have some aha moments for a lot of people. So thank you from the bottom of my heart, brother.
Well, it's my pleasure, Pete. Hopefully we can all learn something. You know, we're all learning day by day, and I think this little, you know, as we'll get into that, some of my sort of the journey I've been on has been eye-opening to me in many ways.
So I want to talk to you about your journey. You are a doctor, and I'd just like to understand why you went into this profession and what was your calling?
Yeah, Pete, I mean, I spent a lot of years as an orthopedic surgeon. I mean, my background, I was always an athlete, so that, you know, that sort of led me towards that particular field because it's, you know, it has a lot to do with the musculoskeletal system. And as someone who's been training and lifting weights and competing in sports, I was very much kind of in tune with that and familiar with that. It was a place of comfort for me. But I mean, honestly, from, you know, the age of a little kid, I tried to understand what was going on just, you know, from a scientific standpoint. That the science has always fascinated me. I thought the human body was, and biology, quite honestly, was quite fascinating. And so I kind of just, you know, from about age 15, I think I decided I wanted to go into medicine. And then I kind of started making the preparations to do so. And spent the early part of my life, you know, preparing for that, and took a few detours. You know, I went down to your part of the world and played rugby a bit with the New Zealand folks, who might be kind of the Australian enemy, so to speak. But
we're all good mates.
No, but yeah, I mean, you guys got to stick together in the Southern Hemisphere. But I know there's that little Tasman Sea underhand bowling rivalry going on down there, so I know a little bit about that stuff. But yeah, so I mean, I really enjoyed just making a difference in people's lives. And I continue to do so today in a little bit different way than I was in the past. But that was what, you know, had me interested and keeps me, yeah, it's rewarding. You know, I think there's, you know, there's the things you enjoy in life, the sort of tangible things, but then there's so many intangible things that come with just, you know, making a difference in someone else's life.
Mm. It's really interesting. I just had a dear friend of mine on the podcast, another orthopedic surgeon called Dr. Gary Fetke, who's a prominent voice here in Australia for encouraging his patients and other people to cut down on their sugar.
He was actually silenced by our medical association for telling his patients, hey, you should cut down, or maybe you want to consider cutting down your sugar, because he was amputating limbs for type 2 diabetic patients. And the Medical Association and the Dietetics Association of Australia came out swinging. And he's had this battle for the last few years, which he just came through about a month ago, and he was issued an apology. So it's really interesting. I've had now two orthopedic surgeons that are both promoting a dramatically reduced sugar intake. And in one form, we have you, Dr. Sean Baker, who is basically saying, you don't need any of that at all. Tell us a little bit about, do you know Gary by any chance?
In fact, I do know Gary. I've talked to him. Actually, you know, Peter, I'm not sure if you know, Zach Bitter and I also have a podcast. We had Gary on a few months ago. Yeah, Gary is a wonderful guy and doing a great service to not only his patients, but just to the community in general. And I think I certainly, you know, empathize with Gary. I mean, I've cut off plenty of my own diabetic feet, toes, fingers, legs, and it's tragic. And the sad thing is, in most cases, those could have been avoided. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just out of frustration. You know, you get tired of being a physician and the system kind of somewhat is set up to not really allow you to do what needs to be done in some cases. And so, yeah, I do know Gary, and Gary and his wife Belinda is also doing some interesting work around nutrition. And so they are a pretty interesting team.
Yeah, they are. And especially their uncovering of the sanitarium organization and where that stems from and where it's leading, and wonderful information that's coming to light. So let's talk about, you are known presently, or one of the things you're known for, I mean, you hold world records. You're also the face, I would say, and the body probably, and the brains behind the carnivore diet and the carnivore approach. And I'd love for you to be able to define to our listeners what the carnivore diet or approach means in its most simplistic form.
Sure. And I mean, and I just, to be fair, there are a number of brilliant people that have done this and have participated and are still participating in this. And I'm one of many, just to, you know, be fair to everyone else. But I have been very vocal. And I think for many people, particularly people, you know, that have a lot of medical problems that have not been able to be solved by physicians, you know, we have a lot of what we call idiopathic diseases, which means we don't know the reason why it occurs. And I think in some cases, it's probably a nutrition basis. And I think that this sort of diet, and I'll get into that in a little second, is kind of sorting some of that information out. You know, things, particularly things like autoimmune disease and some of these awful gastrointestinal illnesses like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis and depression. And a lot of these things are all that may be related to the gut. But the carnivore diet basically is, in its basic form, is just eating a bunch of meat, you know, and, you know, you throw in a few eggs here and there, and maybe a touch of dairy from time to time. But, you know, I think it eliminates some things that are potentially irritating for people. And I think at the end of the day, you know, we've had this 100 years or probably more of demonizing. We can go back to talking with Gary Fecky and his wife Melinda about the demonization of red meat and meat in general as it's some sort of poison to our body, even though we've been eating it as human beings. You know, if you believe in evolution for, you know, perhaps 3 million years. And so it just doesn't make sense to say that now, in the last 50 years, it's been the cause of all the ills that have occurred health-wise in the world. And so, I mean, it's something that, you know, there are historical populations that have clearly survived for long periods of time eating a meat-based or primarily almost completely meat-based diet and done quite well. And historically, were known to be, you know, relatively disease-free. And this is just something that kind of mimics that. I think people can use it as a tool, like anything else. It's a tool in your tool chest of things that you can use to figure out how to solve problems. And I think a lot of people are doing that. I think it's surprising a lot of people, because obviously, I mean, if you just eat meat, then you're not eating fruits and vegetables. You're not eating whole healthy grains. You're not eating fiber. You're eating too much meat, obviously, if you're just eating meat. So it goes really 180 degrees in exact opposition to what we've been told. And rather than people getting really sick, what we're seeing is quite the opposite, which I think is, it's interesting. And it calls into question what we really don't know and what we do know.
So what brought you to this realization or this experiment or this way of life where you just said, all right, I'm going to go and eat meat for a period of time and see how I feel. What was the catalyst for you?
Well, I mean, honestly, you point back to sports. I mean, I've always been a competitive athlete, and I like to see what I can do as far as training and nutrition and recovery that help. And this is something that, you know, I'd already been on like a ketogenic diet for a couple of years and noted improvements in a lot of things, you know, particularly health quality. You know, joint pain was improved, sleep was improved, digestive health was improved, and all those things kind of help with performance. When you add performance up, there's a whole bunch of things that go into that. And those things, if you're not healthy, you don't perform as well. And so I was just reading about, you know, some of the older athletes from years that gone by that had primarily had, you know, steak and eggs type diets and how that seemed to help them. I thought I'd just try it for a while, and what the heck, why not? I mean, I enjoy steak, and so I tried it for a couple of weeks, and then I, you know, I felt pretty good. And then I went back to, you know, cycling in different foods, and then I tried it for a little longer. And then I remember at the end of 2016, so we're coming up right on the 2-year anniversary, I said I was going to do it for 30 days. And at this point, I had already been kind of active on social media, so we kind of, you know, made a little sport of it, a little game, a little joke of it, and I, you know, put a poll: what am I going to die of, scurvy, or am I going to seize up and have a heart attack? And just kind of played around. And you know, of course, none of those things happened. And at the end of the 30 days, I thought, well, that was good. You know, it was a fun experiment, and I felt pretty good. And then I went back to kind of the regular diet I had been on, and I just noticed I didn't feel quite as good. And I said, well, you know, all things being equal, I'd rather feel good and perform better. And so I went back to doing that, and I continued pursuing it. And then pretty soon, 2 months turned into 3, turned into 6, turned into a year, and now turned into 2 years. And I mean, I just continue to perform better as an athlete, continue to feel better, continue to notice continued improvements in my health. You know, I'm in my early 50s now, and I literally, I mean, not to sound like a total crazy person, but I literally feel myself kind of going backwards as far as what's going on with aging. You know, a lot of things I was able to do in my things I couldn't do in my mid 40s, I can now do in my 50s, you know, as far as athletic performance, strength. Just noticed that I'm, you know, improving steadily, and it continues to happen. So that is pretty remarkable in my view.
What I love about that story is I had Rob Wolf recently on the podcast as well. And I was asking him, how do you work out what is the best thing for you? And he said, it's really interesting. He uses his training as the barometer for his understanding of his body. So he says, if you eat a certain way and you're training to your capacity or what you're normally training is, if you feel good after your workout and you can sustain, or actually he said, if you can improve your workload through your training or sporting activities or whatever it may be and feel great, then he said, that's your perfect barometer for where your body feels great. And you're echoing that state that you felt great through your training. And you've been training for a long time, and I'd love for you to be able to share to the listeners what you do, because it's fascinating. And I want to put it into some kind of context, the amount of energy that you expend.
Yeah, Pete, I mean, first of all, let me just say, I mean, you know, I've talked to Rob Wolf before, and I think he has a very nice philosophy about how you look, feel, and perform being probably the best marker for determining, you know, what you should be doing. I think we try to parse out and dissect health down to the smallest molecule, and it gets very confusing for people. And then, you know, there's all these sort of rushes to change our patterns based on the latest study or the latest biomarker that comes out. And I think, you know, the big picture thing is, you know, I want to continue to feel good. I want to continue to perform good. I want to continue to maintain, you know, a healthy body composition. I don't want my knees to hurt. I don't want my digestion to be bad. Those things, I think all of us, it just makes sense. You know, intuitively, it makes sense. If those things are well, probably you're maintaining health. But, you know, for my training, you know, you're right. I've been a lifelong athlete. I've been competing. I went down to lived down across the way from you in New Zealand and played rugby for a few years at a fairly high level. I got to play in their premier leagues, you know, in the, you know, rugby league, no, sorry, rugby union. And, you know, with some of the All Blacks were in the competition. So I got to step on field with some of those guys, which is obviously high level. I did pretty high level powerlifting younger. I was, I got up to a 350 kilogram deadlift as a lifetime drug free athlete, which was at that time a national record. I went in and did some strongman competitions, you know, where you pull the trucks and lift the big Atlas stones, and did that for a few years and had a lot of fun with that. And then I got into the Highland Games, which you may or may not be familiar with, where, you know, it's obviously from Scotland, and you run around in a kilt throwing big things, throwing cabers and different various weights. And I ended up winning a Masters World Championship. At this point, I'd already been turned into my 40s. And then I played around a little track and field. I threw the discus a couple times, and there's something called the super weight and the weight throw, which are kind of similar. And I ended up throwing All-American, Masters All-American distances for that. And then I went on to what I'm doing now, which is this silly indoor rowing things on the Concept 2 machines, which are probably anybody that does CrossFit or obviously the rowers are very familiar with that. And so there's, you know, they've been tracking records at various distances for about the last, I think, almost 40 years on this machine. And so I recently set 3 world records on it at various different distances. And so, you know, when I turned 50, it was kind of interesting. When I turned at age 49, I broke the U.S. records for the 40 plus category. So I was, you know, almost turning 50, but I was able to break the 40 year old records. And then, then right when I turned 50, I switched over to the carnivore diet, and I noted actually a pretty significant improvement in my results. You know, I saw about an 8 to 10% improvement in, you know, my power output capacity in both rowing power and, you know, strength in the gym, which I thought was pretty darn unique. So, yeah, I went on to break the 50-plus world record for 500 meters, which was at that time it was like 1 minute 18.3 seconds, and I ended up bringing it down to 1:14.6. So I took about 4 seconds off the standing world record, which was pretty decent time. And that time was pretty comparable to guys in the 20s and 30s. And a lot of the Olympic rowers that, you know, compete would have a hard time. And most of them can't do a 500 that fast. And so even though I'm, you know, in my 50s now, I'm still able to compete with these younger guys. Granted, we train for a little bit different distances, and strength certainly helps. So. But yeah, it's something I train in. Right now I'm trying to break this 1,000 meter record. And so that's been a little bit of a thorn in my side trying to get that distance. Cause it's, a lot of pain and pain and suffering for the greater good, I suppose. I don't know why I do this stuff, but just kind of get a little bit obsessed about it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about movement exercises and your training, and over the years you've played so many different sports and achieved so much in your life. And for anyone that's thinking of starting a training or workout routine, over the years, what do you think are the, say, a couple or a few of the most fundamental and the ones that you would recommend for anybody that is interested in developing their body, making sure that they're moving it properly? What are the ones you can't go without, or the ones that you would recommend?
Well, I think, you know, again, and I want to put this in perspective for lifetime fitness and what are the things that are important to maintain as we age to maintain health. And I think, you can't just say one or two things. I think I like to put things into big categories. You know, I think that it's important to maintain lean muscle mass. I think we need to do that to protect us from, frankly, from disease. You know, we know that maintaining lean muscle mass protects us from cardiovascular disease, fractures, dementia, and even cancer. And so that's an important component, I think. So, you know, just generalized strength training, and then, you know, some of the, you know, what people do when they do bodybuilding, more of the hypertrophy type work. I do think it's important to maintain cardiovascular fitness. And so, you know, there's several ways, you know, some people like to do it with endurance training. Other people like to do, you know, people that might be more time compressed like to do high intensity interval type training. And so I tend to favor that. I do think it's important to be able to still move, though. I do, you know, I agree. You should be able to jump. You should be able to throw. You should be able to run. You should be able to sprint. And so I do a lot of those type of things. I do a lot of jumping. I do a lot of sprinting. I do a lot of throwing type exercises for the upper body, because that's the best. That's kind of jumping for the upper body. You know, you can't really. You can do some calisthenic pushups that way, but I mean, I do think that using medicine balls and kettlebells and different. Getting outside, just finding a hill, running up and down hills, I think can be a great exercise. I know you get out and do a little bit of surfing. I've seen some of your posts on social media. That sounds like a great thing too. I wish I would have learned how to do that, but maybe one day, maybe you can teach me someday, Pete. I don't know.
Mate, I'd love to. And when you're in this training and when you're doing these things, you're using your breath, obviously, as one of your tools to get to where you want to get to. So I want to understand what goes through your mind or your body when you are going through these peak experiences or these world record titles that you're going for. Do you go into a state of meditation? Do you go into a state of flow? Do you really concentrate on your breath work? I want to understand that side of Sean Baker as well.
Yeah, Pete, it's interesting. And sometimes I wish I knew a better answer, because sometimes it's really tough. And it's just like I have to, you know, really motivate myself to do one of those efforts. And I do them pretty frequently. But I find that, you know, particularly when it comes to rowing, because it's a very repetitive type of thing. And so you kind of just, I get into, you know, just maintaining a very efficient form. It's about being efficient. It's about not wasting any movement. You know, the movement has to be very fluid and very directed as to what you're trying to accomplish with each phase of that. So, you know, and usually what I like to do, you know, because I usually go out and calculate ahead of time exactly, you know, if I'm going to go for X period of time, I know exactly how many, you know, rowing strokes I want to take. So I calculate that out and I just count. And I know that every 2 seconds I'm supposed to pull another stroke. And so I kind of just get into that rhythm and then hopefully get lost in that a little bit. And then I know there's a level of discomfort. And then when you're really going for these really hard efforts, the real discomfort only comes for a short period of time. It may be for 20 seconds, it may be for 30 seconds. And you just got to tell yourself ahead of time, all I've got to do is push myself for that short period of time. And it's surprisingly how hard sometimes that is, even though it's 20 seconds of pain. That's why I noticed recently that you started pursuing, or maybe you've been doing it for a while, but some of the ice baths and the cold shower type things. And I've been doing that stuff for years, but it's the same sort of thing that if you sort of prepare yourself, you know, for that little short period of discomfort, and we all have to face that. I think that's one of the great things about doing those types of things is not only are there other benefits, but I think there's that mental aspect of preparing yourself to face that. You know, it's really facing fear, because it's fear of discomfort or fear of, you know, pain or fear of whatever that you have to get through. And so I think myself, if I can just get to this point, and then once I'm, you know, then I almost go on autopilot. And it's just kind of like, deal with it for 20 seconds, deal with it for 30 seconds, and don't quit no matter what. And then usually the result's pretty good. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of apprehension. Sometimes it takes me 24 hours of mental preparation to prepare myself for that 20 seconds of discomfort. It's kind of mind-boggling how much that can, that there's anxiety in that. Some days I can just get down there. And, you know, honestly, though, Pete, I think the best times is when I don't think about it. I just hop on there and go. And I just go, you know, because you can make it worse than it is. And that's what I trouble. That's why I like to do it frequently, because I know I did it yesterday. It's not going to be that much harder today. And all I've got to do is a tenth of a second faster the next day. And that's why I like to do these really hard efforts very frequently. And I know it may not jive with some people's training programs, but mentally it works pretty well for me, because I know if I did something, it got to a certain distance or a certain time, and all I'm asking myself is 1/10 of a second more. I mean, how much more of that to ask? I know I can already do it. And you know, this is some people talk about going 100%. And I kind of take issue with that, because I feel that if you go 100%, you know, you're basically dead at the end. I mean, you're literally dead. And so I always say, if I've ever given 100%, then I can never do any better. So I always feel that, you know, maybe I pushed myself as hard as I could that day and might have been 80% of what my body's capable of, but it really was difficult. I mean, it was really, really hard. But can I squeak out that 80.1%? You know, I think that's the difference. And so I think this give 100% is kind of a false analogy, when really it's just give as hard as you possibly can on that day, knowing that tomorrow you can do more.
Do you find in those moments of going through the pain or experiencing the pain or getting into that zone that you're talking about, where sometimes you even switch off, do you find that you have realizations about your identity, your life, your existence when you're in those states? Like, what has been the most profound thing that has come through to you in these peak moments?
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, your heart, your life doesn't begin until your heart rate reaches at least 150. You know, I just kind of say that as a joke. But, you know, really, I mean, you're getting in there. And while I'm doing that, you really feel alive. I mean, everything is firing. You know, you think about the sympathetic nervous system, everything is just firing at maximum capacity. And you really feel like, you know, this is what my body is capable of. And so that's actually a very, even though it can be uncomfortable, it's actually a very gratifying feeling. And then, you know, right afterwards, it can be very uncomfortable as you're breathing and trying to catch your breath, and you feel like you're about to drown or something like that, you know, when you do these types of things. But there is some sort of stimulation that occurs that keeps you wanting to do that again. Because honestly, even though these are uncomfortable feelings, you know, this is an uncomfortable feeling at some time, you know, the periods right around it, actually feel pretty good in being able to achieve that and attain that, you know, really is almost an addictive feeling. You know, you feel like it's, you know, you get this endorphin rush, you get this just feeling of being truly alive. You know, when you think about the things that you remember in your life, it's not sitting on the couch. It's not, you know, so, you know, there's some, obviously some nice things that occur, but you know, you really remember those events where your body was pushed to its absolute limit. And I think those things are profound. And I think those experiences are important to have. And I think it's something, like I said, it's something about being alive and being still relevant. You know, like I said, if we were to take away modern society, you know, and to think about how we would have to live, I mean, there would clearly be periods of your life where you are pushed to your limits. We don't see that much today because we, you know, everything is so easily obtainable. You know, it's like whether it's food or luxury or warmth or clothing or shelter, but perhaps that's not how we were initially designed.
I'm loving this. It feels like we're hardwired to experience these peak states of performance, even though we probably wasn't about performance then. It was about survival and these hardships that actually, I don't know, made us grow, made us evolve. And I know every time that I do go into a cold shower, for instance, or I'm in Victoria and it's pretty chilly down here. And I decided to have a swim in the ocean yesterday because I was near the beach and I thought, I'll just jump in because I know after that first initial shock of pain, I know I'm going to feel fantastic for the rest of the day. And it was a small price to pay for a little bit of uncomfortableness. And it was really interesting. We're filming a new documentary at the moment, and my director, who's based in the States, was filming Wim Hof at the same time that I was having a swim in the ocean. So it was pretty surreal that was happening at the same time. And while we're on the training side of things, I'm sure a lot of people, and I'm very interested in, are you a morning person, a midday person, an afternoon person, or a nighttime person for training? Does it matter, or is everybody different, or just do it when you can?
Well, I think obviously the do it when you can is going to be the most realistic message for everybody. You know, there's been some information on world record performances tend to happen in the afternoon for whatever reason. And so I think it depends upon, obviously, you know, my schedule often dictates what I do. I kind of work it around meals sometimes because some of these training sessions don't go particularly well on a full stomach. And so actually I'm going to train right after we get done recording here because I ate about 3 hours ago. And so I'll have enough empty stomach to where I can tolerate one of these really gut-wrenching sessions. But yeah, I mean, I like to get it done early in the day if I can. I can't always do that. But if I can, I like to get it done early in the day. I used to like to train early afternoon years ago when I was younger. I think it just matched with my work schedule, school schedule back then. But really, I think it just depends on the person. One thing I wanted to say about the cold shower stuff and the Wim Hof stuff, it's, you know, with that stress, you know, my daughters and I, we would take ice baths, and I've got little daughters that are ages 10 and 8, and they would get in the ice bath for 5 or 10 minutes, you know, and literally we would all come out and you'd have a state of euphoria, which was kind of interesting. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. You just can't stop laughing almost, even though sometimes you're shivering a little bit, but it definitely elevates your mood. And so I do think those stressful experiences, once they're over and you've survived them, you know, and then you kind of laugh about it. You feel good. So I think that's an important part. But yeah, back to the, you know, the time of day for me, sometimes just getting it over in the morning, and not that I don't enjoy it, but sometimes, you know, if you have a long day and then things pile up, and then sometimes you kind of let it go. And so if you can get up and do it early and get it over with, that's great. If if you've got a job and you do it every day after work, which I did for years, I think that works fine as well. It's just, I think it's a matter of, you know, I think ultimately there's probably a small difference for certain people on timing, but unless you're pursuing like a world record at some point, that's probably not that big of a consideration for most people.
Thanks for that. I know you've seen our film, The Magic Pill, and one of the most profound statements or a few of the things that we included in that film was our dear friend Nora Gagaudis, who wrote the book Primal Body, Primal Mind, and she is one of the biggest supporters or campaigners for inclusion of meat and also its fat, so the protein and the fat, into our diet. And I think she said for 90-something% of our human evolution, and we existed and thrived on a diet that was predominantly, I think, 90% meat and fat. And I know that sounds to some people very hard to believe, but I know you've studied evolutionary history and what that means. And I'd love to hear your take on why meat and its fat is so important for us from a doctor's point of view.
Well, I mean, and I think there's some good evidence to support that. Obviously, none of us have a time machine. None of us can fly back there and see exactly what we were doing. But I mean, there is just tremendous, I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever that human beings, you know, whatever you want to call us, whether it's Homo erectus or Homo sapien, you know, you go back to Homo habilis as perhaps the first quote unquote human about 2.8 million years ago. There's no doubt that they ate at least some quantity of meat throughout history. And there's probably pretty good evidence that, like what you're talking about, that for much of it in many parts of the world, it was a meat predominant diet. I'm just looking at the, and if you look at the paleozoology, you know, just looking at the animal selection that was available 50, 100,000, 200,000 years ago. I mean, we lived in a very different time than we do now. And so we had, you know, vast populations of megafaunal animals, you know, these big elephants, these mastodons, these mammoths, woolly rhinoceros, and the whole gamut of these giant fatty animals that were available. And humans were very efficient at hunting them. We can go back to look at records from Homo erectus, and all they had was spear technology. And even, you know, modern tribes today that still live kind of in that way are very efficient at hunting these animals. Not that we should all be eating elephants now, but the ones that still do that, they're able to do it very easily with very primitive technology, just a spear. One or two guys in the spear can take down an elephant, because elephants or mammoths, they don't run from humans. You know, they just kind of turn and face, or, you know, and so it's very easy to kind of sort of shift those animals where you want them, and then, you know, and then, you know, take them out, and then just, you know, they basically bleed to death anyway for that to happen. But so that's what humans did for a very long period of time, probably from, you know, a million plus years. That's what probably led to much of our development. You know, Dr. Aiello, and I can't remember her partner, proposed, I think, in the 90s, the expensive tissue hypothesis, which we saw a significant reduction in our gut size as our brains grew. And what allowed that to occur was energy-dense food. And the most energy-dense food is fat. And the best place to get fat, you know, the most common place you can get fat is from an animal, a big fatty animal. I mean, you know, obviously there's a few fruits here and there, fruit vegetables here and there, plants here and there that you can get some fat from, but it's not a particularly, you know, common source, and it's not ubiquitous. You know, like I said, if we were to say there was some, you know, starch or some, you know, avocado, which obviously probably didn't exist in any true fashion like we see now back then, or if we're going to get fat from that, and it grows in one area, we would not have been able to migrate all over the world, because humans colonized the entire world. And remember, much of that was during an ice age. So, yeah, I mean, it's clear that we are well adapted physiologically and anatomically to handle meat, you know, fat and protein very well. I mean, we have a stomach acid that's 1.5 among the most acidic environments in the entire animal kingdom. Our stomach acid is very similar to what we see with scavenger animals like vultures, hyenas, even more so than some of these other carnivores. And so it's probably because we possibly started out scavenging. We probably, you know, had these large quantities of meat when we killed these big megafaunal animals that were sitting around, and they probably had some contamination on there. So these things helped us to prevent getting sick when we did that. You know, additionally, we don't have a great fermentative capacity, you know, relative to other animals for dealing with fiber. You know, and I think we do have some capacity. It's on par with, if you look at, you know, just based on anatomy, very similar to what we see with a dog or perhaps even a cat, as far as how much of our intestinal proportion is dedicated to that, which would be the cecum and the colon. We compare that to other, you know, so we have about a 17% capacity from an anatomic standpoint, based on how much of our colon and cecum we have relative to our other intestines. And we compare that to like a pig, which has about 50%, or another primate like a chimp, which might have, you know, 40-50%. And so we've lost much of that capacity. And the trade for that was greater capacity to deal with meat and fat. And that's what drove our evolution. The interesting thing is, and again, this is all this paleo anthropology is interesting, and it's nice to speculate on that. But then again, you say, well, that's all good and well and nice to talk about it. It's fun. I mean, that's interesting stuff. But then at the same time, you go, well, what happens to real human beings in 2018? And you've got people like myself and the thousands of other people that are trying this now, and they're finding out that, wow, it works really well. And so I think that's probably the most compelling evidence that I have is, you know, you can try it right now today and see what happens. And in most cases, most people notice a pretty dramatic improvement in their health if they have health issues, or even in their performance in a lot of times with different athletes.
Well, it's really interesting. I had Michaela Peterson on recently on the podcast, and I came to this realization that had been not bugging me, but in my mind for quite some time. I mean, you've got young children. My daughters now are 12 and 13. And one of the most common questions I am asked is, how do I get my children to eat more vegetables? And I've always thought about this going, why intuitively do kids not want to eat their vegetables? But they love to eat meat. They love to eat the seafood. They love to eat the roast chicken. They love to eat the roast pork. They love to eat the crackling. They love to eat these types of foods. It's never a struggle to get those foods down. And paradoxically, also, if you offer them sugar or things that are addictive in nature, they also will choose to eat them. But the vegetables were always that thing that they're like, oh, Dad, do I really have to eat it? I don't really want to. And I came to a realization that maybe they actually do not want to be eating those vegetables because their bodies are intuitive enough to say, hey, maybe this isn't exactly what I should be eating at this particular point in my life. Maybe I need to be eating more fat, more meat to develop my brain, to develop my body, to grow. And I'd love your take on it because you have young children yourself. So talk me through eating meat and fat for children.
Yeah, Pete. Well, I think, you know, again, if we look at just the history of vegetables, and as a chef, you probably know this fairly well. A lot of the vegetables that we eat today didn't really exist that long ago. I mean, broccoli outside of, I think, Italy, or maybe I can't remember where it originated, but, you know, in many places is only a few hundred years old. And so we've got all these modern vegetables. Obviously, they've been hybridized, they've been cultivated, they've been made palatable because before they were so bitter. And the reason we have a sensation of bitter taste is to protect us from, if we go out in the wild and just start randomly eating leaves, most of them are going to taste bitter. And the reason they taste bitter is because they're bad for us. They'll make us sick. And so I think we've kind of, as adults, we say, well, it's an acquired taste. You know, you can certainly, you know, as a chef, you can make anything taste great, right? You can throw some kale and mix it with some bacon fat. And, you know, I know you have ways to do this stuff. So I think these things are things that we just probably didn't eat a lot of historically. Now, certainly we would have eaten berries when they were accessible, probably some starchy tubers and things like that. As time went on, you know, particularly as these megafaunal animals died off and we were left with, you know, now we need to eat something because we don't have the easy source of fat and calories. And so, but the vegetables, I think, were the last thing that we probably would have chosen, just because, again, think about energy density. There's not much energy. That's one of the reasons why people go on these vegetarian diets or vegan diets. They lose a lot of weight is because there's not a lot of calories in a big old bowl of kale or broccoli or spinach, you know, for what you've got to eat. And so why would primitive man, who wasn't watching his weight, who wasn't counting calories, who wasn't, you know, following around worrying about micronutrients, why would he even bother to eat those things? It would have been like not much taste for a hell of a lot, for not much energy at all and not much taste. So they would have chosen to eat the things that taste good and gave them the most calories. We unfortunately don't suffer from that same issue today because we have so many easy calories that, you know, we've engineered to taste great. And so we have no problem with that. And so, but if you think about the problems posed back then, it was getting enough food, getting enough calories, and vegetation would probably not have figured very prominently in that scenario. Now, as far as kids go, I think, you know, I think meat is essential to the diet. I think animal fats, animal proteins are just essential. And so I offer that to my kids. I just, you know, I don't, most of the time they steal it. You know, if I'm cooking a steak, they're already telling me they want this part, the fatty part, and they take it from me. But I think, you know, once kids get used to that, and, you know, you have to kind of wean them off all the garbage, you know, the sugary stuff, the quote unquote natural organic junk food that's out there. You know, we all see that stuff in the store that's labeled as organic and natural. And you look at the first five ingredients and there's some sort of processed grain with a vegetable oil and some kind of sugar in there, you know, or natural sugar, which guess it's basically a bunch of garbage. So you have to get them off of that stuff first, and then they're going to get their energy. If they're not getting their energy from a bunch of sugar, they're going to want to get it from an animal source, and typically the fat, which is important. And so my little boy eats eggs for breakfast every single morning. I get him and make him a couple eggs. He'll eat some sort of meat for dinner and something. That'll be part of his lunch. And then if they want to eat, you know, something beyond that, if they're still hungry. The nice thing about is if you really load them up on the animal fats and the animal proteins, they're not wanting to snack every 15 minutes. You know, normally kids are constantly hungry because what we do is we break out the granola bar and then the little juice box and we give it to them. And, you know, 20 minutes later, they're still hungry. And we know why that's occurring, you know. But if you give them a big old, you know, hunk of steak and they like it and they eat it, and you don't hear from them for 4 or 5 hours, which is kind of nice from a parenting standpoint, just because you're not constantly having to cook and deal with these kids for food. And so I don't believe anybody should be made to eat any particular way. I mean, I think with parents and kids, you have to make sure they get adequate nutrition. And then let them have some choice in what they're going to want to eat. Again, I think that the one thing about being on this carnivorous diet is it shows that it's sufficient for health, and it's probably central to nutrition. And then beyond that, it becomes, what do you want to do for flavor? What do you want to do for a little bit of variety? And you know, you figure out what you can tolerate, what things are, you know, because little kids usually are pretty metabolically healthy most of the time. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing more and more kids where that's not the case, because we start them off eating, you know, they go on baby formula, a lot of them that aren't breastfed, and then the first ingredient on that is corn syrup and soybean oil. You know, so they start off, they're already hooked on this sugar, and then they go right on to some sort of rice cereal-based product next with sweeteners added to it most of the time, and then some kind of, you know, high-sugar yogurts, and it's from the day they're born, basically. And so they're kind of programmed just to be craving sugar constantly. And I think that's a shame. And that's not how it was even 50 years ago.
Mm. And what I love about that, and talking about the evolutionary history of, we'd have berries popping up on the trees or the shrubs during the times of the year, and also the tubers. And it's interesting because my kids, that's their favorite food. They love the berries. They love the sweet potato. When you cook it with the meat and things like that, like that, they're the things that they just generally go for. And I'm the same, cup of broth or chicken soup or something for the kids. And there's always some eggs. There's generally some sort of meat or seafood on there as well, and a small amount of greens. And we also have some kimchi or sauerkraut on the plate. And they have a cup of broth as well. And they're full. They get so much food at breakfast time that the next time is lunchtime, whereas some kids are just hungry all the time. And we notice it when kids are on holidays. They generally only eat two meals with us. Like, they'll have a late breakfast, which is big, you know, probably twice as big as most kids probably eat, and then an early dinner. And it's quite a big meat-filled or seafood-filled dinner. And it's interesting because I never hear, "Dad, I'm hungry," or anything like that, because they're satiated. And I feel like their body is getting that nutrition. I know you're active on social media, and I love following your page. And I was a raw vegan from the age of 19 to 22, approximately. I attended an Anthony Robbins workshop, and he was promoting the Fit for Life diet back then. And I went off on my merry way, thinking I was doing the right thing for my body. And this is going back 25 years. And I felt great for about 6 months. And then on and on and on over the next 3 years, my health deteriorated. But I held on to life, basically, that I thought I was doing the right thing for my body and for the planet and for the health of the animals, until I had to change to actually survive and thrive. And I noticed that you're posting a lot of information at the moment, or a lot of stories of vegetarians and vegans that have adopted a carnivorous diet or a ketogenic meat-based diet. And I want to understand what it is that you're trying to show here, because I know you've been vocal against certain people that have attacked you from that side of thing. Are you hoping to share inspiration or show how easy it is to regain your health?
Well, I think it serves a couple of purposes, really, Pete. I think, you know, there is obviously a very large sort of push to get us off as a society, you know, or as a culture from eating meat. And I think that's essential to our health. I think people that, you know, will say, well, that's sort of a secondary importance, basing saying that it's an environmental issue or it's an animal rights issue. And I think you can't sort of divorce humans from human health. I think we have to maintain it and keep that at the front. And so, you know, what I try to do is I show these are the people that are thriving on a meat-based or an all-meat diet. And then these are the people that have tried the plant-based diet and they have not, they've had really significant health issues. And so we have to recognize that not all of us can do that. Now, there are people that seem to do pretty well on a plant-based diet if they do it right, if they supplement appropriately, you know, and I think that should be their prerogative and their right. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm told what I can and cannot eat. You know, if I wanted to eat a bunch of mm-hmm. junk food and sugar, that should be my prerogative. I think that's just our own choice. I mean, I think it's a personal choice type issue. And so I think that just by highlighting some of this stuff, it shows that, you know, we can't all be forced to eat one particular way because there's going to be some negative consequences from that. And even if you say, well, we're going to save suffering on animals, and I think that's a very contentious topic to start with. But even if you believe that, you have to say, well, wait a minute, how much human suffering are we willing to tolerate in the name of animal liberation or animal rights? And I think we can't forget the human beings are animals too, and we still count here. And so I think that is something that we need to, you know, be aware of, because there is sort of this picture that we can all go adopt a plant-based diet and everything's going to be great and the world's going to be saved and no animals will ever die again and no animals will ever suffer. And I think it's obviously not a real scenario, obviously. And I'm kind of just being a little lighthearted about this stuff, but I think it's a necessary thing to show that, you know, we can't just sweep this stuff under the rug and pretend it doesn't exist. There are, as more and more people try a plant-based diet, and I think that's fine to do it. They should try it if they want to. More and more people will find it doesn't work for them. And I think that's something that just needs to be made out there. Because a lot of, like I said, you were 19. Most people that adopt this sort of this lifestyle are young. They're very optimistic. They're very, they don't have as much experience. You know, I know there's a lot of push to get these kids, even in, you know, grade school, when they're 6, 7 years old, telling them that you don't need to eat animals. You don't need to eat that chicken. He's so cute. Don't eat him. Don't eat the cow. And I think there's a lot of damage potentially that can occur to these people, both physically and even sometimes psychologically. And so I think that's something that, you know, we need to realize that forcing young people to go down this path may not be in their best interest.
Mm, I love looking at your page and seeing what you do, because you have this steadfast approach to not wavering to other people's beliefs that they want to put onto you about how you can eat. For instance, and I love how you said, you know, if you want to eat all the junk food in the world, then so be it. It's your choice. And if you choose to eat a certain way to be healthy, then so be it. And you're not attacking anybody for their personal choice, but also you won't be told what to do. Because as you said, and I think a lot of people forget that, we as humans are animals and we need our own welfare. And that was definitely my journey. And so many people in the paleo, ketogenic, I guess carnivore, probably have gone down the plant-based approach. And it's interesting because I just released a book about plant-based diet celebrating vegetables. And I spoke to my publisher about it. It was about a year and a half ago. And I said, I really want to put a plant-based book out there, because I feel like there's a huge movement towards vegetarian and veganism that is happening. And from my own experience, it isn't I don't think it's the right path for everyone. So I want to put a book out there that celebrates vegetables, but at the core of it, it's to be used as an addition to a plate of meat or a plate of seafood or something. So if you're going to eat vegetables, then make sure you have a plate of seafood or meat or eggs and add this to it and make it sexy. And I thought, you know, maybe there's room for that out there, having a vegetarian or a plant-based book. And some of my recipes have bacon in there or different types of eggs or meat in there as well, or seafood. And it's really interesting, because the other day I had somebody come on my page and saying, I'm really upset at you for putting a book out there that celebrates vegetables, but you haven't listed the vegan recipes in there. I said, I'm sure you can work it out yourself, which ones are vegan or not. But it's been an interesting journey so far. And I'm actually doing a talk with one of the world's most famous vegetarians, David Avocado Wolf, And I had him over for lunch. My wife and I cooked for him and his friends the other day. We cooked a beautiful vegetarian feast. And it was interesting because the next morning I said to my wife, I said, geez, those vegetables tasted really good, but I felt like there was one thing missing. And that was some meat, you know, for that sustenance. I could just feel it. So it's an ongoing journey for me, and I'm looking forward to going full carnivore to do this experiment early next year. And have you got any tips? Because coming from a chef background and having variety of food is sort of inbuilt into my nature of expression, because I see cooking as a creative art form and a wonderful way to bring different flavors and different experiences to my life. Do you have any any advice?
Well, I think, you know, particularly, and I just want to comment that, you know, I don't think that necessarily vegetables are bad for us, you know, for everybody. I mean, it's just that I don't think carbohydrates are necessarily bad for us. I think that food is a mixture of things that are great and wonderful and taste good and are good for us. And then there are some substances in food that are, for some people, problematic, and you just have to sort that out. You know, it may be that, you know, spinach is wonderful and great for you and even me, perhaps, but, you know, for the other people, it may be the oxalates in the spinach cause them issues with their gut. And so I think it's just, those are the things, I think, the issues where we have to kind of make those sort of individual calls. But as far as starting a carnivorous diet, there, as you know, there are a lot of things that come from the animal kingdom. It's not just, you know, a steak every day. I mean, there are so many varieties. There are thousands and thousands of animals in different parts. And as a chef, you can make them all taste delicious. And so I would encourage you just to do that. Just use your creativity, you know, and if you have to use seasoning and spices to fully enjoy that, I think that's fine too. I mean, again, there is a small proportion of people that will react negatively, maybe someone like Michaela Peterson, where a particular spice might set her back pretty bad, you know, from a disease standpoint. But absent of that, go ahead and enjoy yourself and do what appeals to you. I think, you know, just when I tell people on the diet, because, you know, if you're no longer getting carbohydrates as a source of fuel, you need to be adequately fueled. And so you have to eat to satiety. You might have to find that, you know, you just have to eat quite a bit to enjoy it. And I say, don't count calories, count how many meals you enjoyed, you know, and then just be decadent about it. I mean, obviously you can do that. As a chef, you can make the most decadent meals, I'm sure, possible, given those constraints. But I mean, there's a lot of ways to, you know, when I was in Iceland earlier this year, and we went to a restaurant in Reykjavik, and one of the restaurants, you know, a very nice restaurant called Burrow, had an entire carnivore menu that they made for a group of us that went out there, and they had a really top chef, and he made all these wonderful recipes, and it was a lot of fun, and we had a great time. But I mean, that's, you may find yourself eating once or twice a day, you know, just because it can be very satiating. It was, you know, probably if you've been on a diet where fat is the main part of your metabolism, that your appetite tends to change. You have to realize that you're not going to get the natural hunger signal that you get with carbohydrates, which is kind of an almost a crisis-like thing where I'm just really, really starving. And if I don't eat something, if I don't eat that cookie in the next 10 seconds, I'm going to rip somebody's head off. Instead, it's just more of a subtle, you know, sense of, I probably should eat something soon. And you have to sort of think that, you know, sometimes I'm just not, my energy's a little low, or I'm just not feeling, my mood's a little down, or something like that may be a signal to eat, because with time, you know, your hunger signal is trying to change. And it's just kind of like, yeah, I'll probably feel a little better if I eat something. Not so much that it's a cellular, I'm running out of glucose emergency, like is what happens when you're on a more of a carbohydrate-based metabolism.
That's really interesting, because over the last year or two, I feel like sometimes I get away with just wanting to eat one meal, but I've noticed I've lost a little bit of weight over that last year. And it's like, okay, it's not that I need to force myself, but because I don't have that hunger anymore, like, okay, well, I want to start training. I want to start building my body. I'm going to have to eat more. And that's why it's really interesting having this carnivore discussion at the moment, because that's what I feel like I need to be eating more of, more meat, more seafood. And it's fascinating because two of my favorite cuisines to eat is Japanese and Chinese. And whenever I go to a Japanese restaurant, I just eat carnivorous. It's basically, I get sashimi and then I might get a piece of fish or a piece of meat. and very, very satiating. And for Chinese, we have some really good Chinese restaurants here in Australia that I take my family to and my children to. And we get the roast duck, or we get the roast pork, maybe the one of the chicken dishes, and then steamed fish. And we get the obligatory, if that's the right word, a plate of greens on the side. You know, it could be some garlic chives or some water spinach or Chinese broccoli. But sitting there with my children, you would swear that they are animals in the nicest possible way when that roast duck and roast pork comes to the table. It's like this race to eat it. But obviously, we have to eat mindfully, like slow down. But it's like when I had Leah Keith in the Magic Pill documentary, she's talking about if you ever want to see a happy duck or a happy chicken, let them eat bugs and you'll see the real definition of joy. And it's the same thing I feel with when I take the kids to these nice Chinese restaurants. That plate of duck comes down and all of a sudden it just flicks this switch for them. That, I don't know, it feels innately that they know that this is good for them. So, yeah, I could have a lot of fun with the carnivorous diet for sure. Because I was worried, not worried, but from what I've seen talking to Michaela and seeing your post, is it seems to stick to red meat. But you're saying go for it with any type of animal, sustainable.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think what happens is many people that do this long-term, you know, they just tend to prefer red meat. I think that's probably, you know, if we go back from an evolutionary standpoint, Pete, and we think about, you know, if I give you a spear and I say, go hunt this big fat animal that doesn't run very fast, or go chase down this bird with your spear, I mean, you know, you're going to be more successful and you're more likely to get more meat out of the big slow one than you are the fast bird that flies away. And so I think that's probably what we did. I think there's probably some argument that there's maybe a little more nutrition, you know, in red meat for certain nutrients. And so I think that's probably why many people find them. But I'll eat seafood from time to time. I still enjoy that quite a bit. It's not my main focus of my meal, but I like it every time I eat it. You know, the other thing I would say for me is, you know, and I still like the taste of things like chicken or duck, particularly. Duck is wonderful. You know, I really like, you know, some really great duck breasts. But, you know, when I eat chicken breasts, which I used to eat a lot when I was younger, I mean, it's like, when's the real food going to get here? It's kind of like an appetizer at this point. And so, you know, it's like, you know, that really juicy, fatty, I don't know, you guys call maybe scotch fillets down there or ribeye steaks. That really kind of hits the spot. You know, it gets kind of, you kind of get satiated with the right amount of protein, that wonderful, you know, fat that gives it the flavor. And I'm sure as a chef, you appreciate the flavor that fat imparts to the dishes. And so I think it's the reason it's so delicious is because it's also, you know, nutritious and we're wired to eat it.
There's a couple of things before we wrap this up, but and I guess for any vegetarian or vegan that is probably thinking about adopting this that might be listening, if we look at the size of the animal, obviously if we're taking the life of a cow, for instance, that cow is going to feed a lot of people, whereas you're going to have to kill and take the life of many, many chickens to feed the same amount of people through that process as you would with one cow, for instance. So there's a philosophy of thought there that why potentially eating these larger animals is actually a more sustainable and more ethical approach. Do you have any thoughts on that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, somebody put out something called, I think they call it the sentience quotient, or, you know, to basically, does it make more sense to eat one large animal and live for many, many months, or does it make more sense to eat, you know, hundreds of smaller animals? And some people say, I'd rather not eat any at all. And I mean, that's obviously, there's no way to just sort of make that happen, because as we know, anything we do as human beings involves some sort of compromise from another creature, whether it's living in a home or driving a car or wearing clothing. I mean, it's going to impact other animals. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you think about it, if people that do this, you know, and people are criticized this, but, you know, some of the folks that live up in the northern reels that still hunt whales, I mean, they'll kill a whale, and that may be food for a whole village for, you know, maybe close to a year. And so it's like, you know, there's one animal that had to die to feed this whole village. And so the question is, well, whales are big and beautiful, you know, but how intelligent are they? relative to a rabbit. They're probably arguably slightly more intelligent. But again, it's you know, I think when we sort of realize that as human beings, you know, I mean, somebody's going to eat me when I'm dead. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's the way of the world. I mean, I'm going to be eaten by worms or bacteria. And so all these animals, whether we end up eating them or not, are going to die. Most of them are going to die at the hands of another animal, you know, particularly the you know, these antelope and gazelle and deer and, you know, even domestic cows. If we didn't eat them, they would be eaten by wolves or something else. And so it's just, why not honor their death by eating them and at least making use of their, you know, their sacrifice? And it's not just that we eat the meat. That's the thing. When we eat a cow, all those other body parts, you know, it goes into, you know, if people talk about it's bad to have leather, we're like, why would you kill the cow and then throw away all that stuff and not utilize every ounce of that animal for leather, for gelatin, for there's all kind of medical uses we get from these animals. It's amazing. If you look at what all products are derived from cattle, it's there's hundreds of them. And so I think that, yeah, you're absolutely right. Is it one animal or is it 100 animals? Does it make any difference or not? You know, that's, again, this is more of a religious discussion, and I think we should divest our nutrition from that.
And last question before we wrap it up is, in my research over the years, AGEs, and I won't even, I know you'll understand what this means, and maybe you can give us a definition, but cooking meat over intense heat produces something called an AGE, which some people believe isn't that great for us from a health point of view. Whereas others think that if you can slowly cook meat without high intense heat, say, for instance, you get some beef cheeks or some short ribs or some oxtail, for instance, if we're talking about beef here, and slowly simmer it in some water or broth to lessen the high intense carcinogenic is the word, I think, that comes out in a lot of people's research in cooking meat over high intense flames or into a pan. What are your thoughts on that? Because I noticed that often you're posting a photo of just cooking steak in a pan or over a fire. So I wanted to take your thoughts on this, because obviously you mustn't think there's anything majorly concerning with this approach.
Yeah, Pete, that's a good question. And it's I think it's an important question. So first of all, there's some thought that red meat contributes to increasing your risk for colon cancer, right? If you look at the World Health Organization 2015, they declared that red meat was a class 2 carcinogen, processed meats were a class 1 carcinogen. That was based on what's called epidemiology, where they looked at a bunch of population data and they said, well, people that tend to eat more meat have slightly higher rates of colon cancer. So if we look at the absolute risk in the normal population, your risk would be about 4%, about 4.5% of getting colon cancer. If you ate more meat, that risk would go up to about 5.5%. So it's about a 1% increase in your risk, which is not really much. It's very little. They then did the number, the statistics on that, and said, well, that represents about a 17% increase in what's called relative risk, to make it sound more concerning. Now, epidemiology really can't generate any kind of good hypothesis until you see about a 200% increase in risk of that sort of thing happening. And so there's been numerous critiques, including a guy named Kerfeld, who was on that committee. And he basically said the committee was filled with folks that were either vegans or vegetarians. About a third of the committee was made of that. They only looked at about 18 studies out of the 800 they cited. They only referenced 18 of them. They completely ignored data that refuted that stuff. And so he voted against it. He was, you know, he was overruled. So there's some very big problems with declaring meat as a carcinogen in the first place. And I don't think that, in my view, meat is not a carcinogen. So any mechanism, whether it's heterocyclic amines, which come from cooking polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or the advanced glycation end product, which you refer to as AGEs or AGEs, I don't think any mechanism by which you propose there's increased risk of cancer holds up. Because when you look at population studies, again, that control for those confounders, you know, instead of saying, I've got a big obese guy who's diabetic that goes to McDonald's and eats French fries and Cokes, and oh, by the way, he has a hamburger. Comparing him to someone like myself who is meticulous about his health, doesn't eat junk food, exercises, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, actually cares about my health, that's two different populations. And so, again, if we look at what are the things that drive colon cancer outside of this small 18% relative risk increase, supposedly attributed by epidemiology, though, if you look at being obese, you know, basically has about a 200% increased risk for colon cancer. So if you're not obese, if you eat red meat and you get leaner and you reduce your risk from 200% down to, you know, normal, does that offset the 18%? The other things are, if you're hyperinsulinemic, you know, if your insulin's high, guess what? Your risk for colon cancer goes way up again by several hundred percent. So again, eating a bunch of meat tends to improve that. So you've got all these things that point the other direction. And so I don't think meat causes cancer in the first place. So how you cook it is probably irrelevant. Think about what was the way we first learned to cook. We didn't have sous vide ovens. We didn't have slow cookers.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we could put it underground with a rock perhaps. But, you know, we cooked over flames for, you know, we've been cooking for maybe 400,000 years. That's what most of the evidence indicates. And so cancer was not an issue to the degree it is now. And we've been cooking forever. So I don't find it to be a problem. I think if you burn your meat beyond recognition, so it's not palatable, you know, if you cook a steak to well done, it's, you know, some people would say you just ruined it anyway. So it's not, you know, it's not really palatable. But yeah. You know, as a chef, I'm sure when somebody orders a well done steak, you kind of grit your teeth and do it. But, you know, so I don't find that a little bit of char on meat is something that I'm greatly concerned with in the big picture. You know, I think there's always, is that worse for me than going eating a bunch of Twinkies and Doritos and drinking, you know, Coca-Cola? I mean, you know, you just have to say, where do you draw the line? Obviously, there has to be a point where you can't do every little tiny thing perfectly. And so, but I really don't think it's a huge risk just because I don't think meat causes cancer. And so these mechanisms that they try to propose are not really valid in my view.
All right. Something just came to me then, and I've never asked anyone on the podcast this, and it often comes up for me, is the blood type diet. Because a lot of people say, well, if you're O type blood, then you're more able to digest and eat meat as opposed to the other blood types. So do you have a theory on this, or is it just nonsense?
I think it is. I mean, here's my thought on that. If your blood is red, then you're able to eat meat. You know, from a blood type. But I mean, no, and this is something, you know, because we've asked that question in these carnivore communities of thousands of people. We've taken polls and said, what is your blood type? And we get a mixture of O and A and B and AB and A minus and O minus. There's no rhyme or reason. There's all kinds of people that have type A blood, which is supposed to be the vegetarian blood, that do just fine on a carnivore diet. So I've not seen any of that held up in actual reality in people that do this. Now, there may be some things outside of meat where, like, you know, maybe there's certain blood types where you can tolerate lactose and some of these foods that came into the human diet later on. You know, they're only a few thousand years old, like dairy and grains and certain vegetables and things like that. But I think meat is so old, you know, from a human perspective, you know, it's 3 million years old, that I think as long as your blood is red, you're fine with that. And that's what I've seen, you know, bear it out. And everyone that I've asked about it that actually cares to submit their blood type.
Oh, I love your response. That's so cool. And lastly, mate, what is one of your ingredients for your recipe for life that you would love to share with the listeners? It doesn't have to be anything to do with food, but what's the one thing that makes you tick that you would love to share, mate?
Yeah, I think, you know, finding out what makes you happy and doing it as much as possible. I think that's the simplest answer that I can give. And I think that goes to what you do from your career, what you do with your family, you know, what you do with yourself. I think those things are, you're only going to be here for a certain period of time and you might as well enjoy it. And don't be afraid of challenges. I think growth is important. I think challenging yourself is essential. And I think you should continue to strive to improve, you know, in some way. And it may be a small way. And it may be something that doesn't mean anything to anybody else, but it's important to you and you need to find out what that is and continue to do it.
Oh, I love it, brother. Thank you so much for today. I've loved asking you these questions, and keep doing what you're doing. Keep breaking records and keep shining brightly and keep spreading your message, because I love seeing all the things that you're promoting and the way that you're doing it as well. So thank you once again from the bottom of my heart. I love you and keep shining, brother. Thank you.
Likewise, Pete, and I look forward to seeing what you do. You look like you got some great things coming up.
Well, I do have a meat book coming out soon, so I'll get you a copy.
I look forward to it.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.